Today we'll be on 114, a number which stirs some traffic trauma for people who live in the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex. But for us, it's the second psalm of the Hallel.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
You can go back and listen to the previous episode on, that is, Psalm 113, to hear more about the Hallel. This psalm is one of those two psalms that's used early in celebratory meals, on holidays, and things like that, that are often repeated, including at the Passover. And this psalm, like 113, is still about the Exodus. But it also, and this is not that distinct from what's possible in 113 either, but it's important to note, it also includes things about their settling in Israel 40 years later, and by implication, something that they would want to know for the rest of their history about that settling. But before we dig into the psalm itself, Daisy, my producer, you also noticed a comment or a question, something like that, that sort of on our website that changed the way that we're going to cover the psalm in this episode.
I did. Yes. It was Joseph, actually. He sent us an email through the website, which you can do on the contact page, in case you're wanting to do so. And his question, I'm going to read some of it and describe some of it. So he says, "Hello, my name is Joseph, and I'm a big fan of your podcast." I paid him to say that. No, joking.
A big fan of the producer
the
on
producer,
your podcast.
Yeah. I was hoping to ask for a better way to understand the Psalms. I'm working on a personal project to better connect with the Psalms, and I feel that there are a lot of details I'm missing. So he says he's not teaching the Psalms. He's using this for his personal devotion, but he really wants to make sure he's going deeper and doing his best, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, well, I love the question. I appreciate it being asked. When I taught preaching on a regular basis, that was a very substantial part of that was learning exposition, learning how to do what, you know, is often referred to as exegesis. So how do you dig into a passage and actually extract from it all the elements of it, the meaning of it, you know, what it's actually supposed to be used for. There's lots of argumentation about how to do this. And certainly with the Psalms, a lot of that argumentation is pertinent. I'm not going to spend my time on this, but I do want to mention it before we start into what I do want to spend my time on and answering that question. You know, one of the bigger questions is whether to approach a text, and especially again, the Psalms are sort of hymnic, you know, so they are sung and they're poetic, and so one of the approaches that you can take to Scripture is simply to read it in the bigger sense. So let's just read through it and let whatever influence it has, whatever impact it has, just let it have it, because throughout most of history, people just sat down with nothing in front of them, and somebody stood up at the front of the room and read it to them, or read it to their children at the table, and they didn't have a copy of it themselves, or they quoted it to each other. And so you are conforming your mind to a text anytime you read it. And the more often you read it, the more you come to think the way that text is causing you to think. That's why it's so valuable to memorize Scripture. And that doesn't entail any kind of special technical knowledge about how to understand which parts of a verb and a noun and, you know, all the grammatical structure and the underlying meta-narratives and so on. All those different elements we like to talk about. I love to do sentence diagramming and all that kind of stuff. But you don't have to have any of that to approach it that way. The other way to approach exegesis, and these are not mutually exclusive, obviously. It's possible that you could do both and learn different things by approaching it in different ways. But the other way is to use technical skills. So say the ability to break down sentences into their grammatical components, or the ability to reconstruct arguments into their components and into the overall flow of the semantic structure of a passage, and so on. There are all of those ways to, or even just noticing the diction, noticing the vocabulary, the actual meaning of the words that are used in the passage, and so on. All of that is a way of saying every single part of the passage is important. This is a book that is inspired by God. And so, and it's fine if you want to say it stronger than that. We believe in inerrancy at the college where I'm the president. So we believe every part of it's true, absolutely true. This is but the nature of that kind of commitment, whether you use the stronger language like we do, or if you just use broad language, this is a sacred text, means every single part of it at least could be important. It is important on my reading of it, absolutely, every single part. And that means I want to notice every single part. And because our normal way of reading things is the self-reinforcing way, it's the way that all of us do with confirmation bias, where we notice the parts that make sense to us automatically and they confirm what we already thought. And then we say, oh, that passage means exactly what I always thought it meant. That's our nature, and therefore we glide past the parts that are a little awkward or didn't make sense to us, or we weren't familiar with, or we just didn't know what that word meant. And so we just glide by that and leave it behind, which means we can have a tendency to leave behind important parts of the text. This is the part, everything I've been saying for the last 5 minutes is the part I'm not going to talk about. Because that discussion, sort of the elements of the hermeneutical spiral, which is the idea that you read something and then you study it, and then the components of it, and there are two different ways to take this spiral, but the components of it then come to mean a little more to you as you go around it again and you study the text again. And then the individual components actually take on a different hue as you look at them after you've studied other components. And so the elements of it have to build on each other over time to get there. All of that's fascinating, and a study in hermeneutics is well worth the entire discipline. We have entire courses of it in theological studies, so I encourage you to pursue that. But what I want to do is more practical, and I don't mean that's not practical, but I mean within, you know, the short span of a podcast where we're talking about it, more practical, but also in the sense of saying, here, you know, let me just give you three or four simple tools to say, well, at least let me do this before I just dismiss the meaning of a psalm into what I've arrived at after having read through it one time. So I would suggest that you take this approach where you say, what I'm going to do is notice how to read this like you would read most poems. There is a part of it that's specific to the psalms, but most poems you would have to do this same thing with. And I'll say three things that you would have to do with every poem if you really want to understand it. Notice these three things in order to interpret a poem, which includes the Psalms. Notice the tropes, notice the motifs, and notice the parallels. Those are inherent components of poetic language. They're just sort of built into it. So what I mean by tropes is how we use figures of speech, how we use literary imagery or symbols in order to get something across. So most of us would think of tropes as, you know, the way things are repeated in culture, and so you see them. You know, it's a trope that a person stumbles on a banana peel or something like that. But what I mean by it is metonymy and synecdoche and metaphors and, similes and things like that. And so, in looking at those, you have to go through a passage. And so let me just give you a first comment on this technique. The first thing you have to do in order to understand a psalm is read it. So just to be clear, this is, if you start by just studying the individual words, you'll never get to the meaning of it. You'll be the person who got lost examining the individual trees and never saw the whole forest. So first, you just have to read the psalm. So let's just make that clear. You have to read it from beginning to end, and you have to just let it flow. And you have to acknowledge that there are some things in it that are going to make you think you understand it right away. But what you do is hold those in abeyance. You hold them like you would hold something loosely enough that you might not really want to have it in your grip when it comes down to it, right? So, oh, well, this makes me think it might be about the covenant. This makes me think it might be about redemption. It might be about whatever. So you hold things in abeyance, but you do. You just read through it first and get a general sense of all the elements that are present in it. After you've read through it, then you go back to read it and you start looking for these elements. So what are some of the tropes that showed up? And by tropes, I mean in this case, I'll give you an example, and we're going to use Psalm 114, so I'm going to read it to you. And what I would expect we'll have to do because of the conversation we're going to have and the fact that anytime I'm talking about a psalm, it takes more than 30 minutes, we're going to need to split this episode up. So we're just going to talk about the method right now, but in order to talk about the method, I do want to use an example. So we're going to use Psalm 114. But I'm not really going to teach it right now. I just want us to kind of have it in the background. So Psalm 114 goes like this. It's short, so we can do this pretty quickly. When Israel went out from Egypt, the house of Jacob, from a people of strange language, Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion. The sea looked and fled, Jordan turned back. The mountains skipped like rams, the hills like lambs. What ails you, O sea, that you flee? O Jordan, that you turn back? O mountains, that you skip like rams? O hills, like lambs? Tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the God of Jacob, who turns the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a spring of water. Okay, now we've read through it. And there are a few things that pop up immediately that make you think, oh, well, maybe this is a covenantal kind of psalm. It certainly does seem to be about the Exodus. It's got some references to leaving Egypt right at the beginning of the psalm. Can't miss any of that stuff. So you have some things you're thinking, yeah, I think I might understand what this is about. Not to mention that historically, we know it's the second psalm of the Hallel. So it's been used historically to talk about the Exodus in the context of remembering the Exodus. So we're not going to be surprised by any of that as we come across it. Now, I've read through the psalm one time, and I have a sense of what's in it, and I know the weird part, you know, the mountains skipping like lambs. I'm going to figure out something about that. And the really weird part, when you get to the end and suddenly we're getting water out of the desert. I mean, there's no desert and no need for water at any point before that. So why is that coming up? And obviously, there's going to be a good cause for it. We believe it's intentional. That's the whole point of reading a poem. When you read a poem from someone who doesn't know how to write poetry, you read it to say to yourself, well, is this any good or not? When you're reading a poem by anybody who knows what they're doing, you read it to say, what did they mean by putting this part in here? Because the whole nature of poetry is that every part is meaningful. So perhaps more so, and this is the opposite of how we actually read the Psalms, we read the Psalms so devotionally that we don't pay attention to any of their details. When in reality, they're poems. Every detail is more important, weightier than it would be in normal prosaic or even narrative literature. You know, you could describe things a variety of ways, but in poetry, it's got to be there for a reason or you don't put it in. Poetry is dense language by its nature. And by the way, I'm saying that, you know, in the nature of a person who loves English poetry and modern poetry, that's true. But our modern poetry is heavily influenced by the early English poets who were interpreting the Psalms. Very many of the early English poems were simply translations of the Hebrew Psalms. So the way we learned to develop poetry in English was shaped heavily, strongly influenced by Hebrew poetry. It's a huge advantage for us going back and looking at the Psalms that we can just apply the things that we would apply normally to poetry. Okay, so back to the point here. We've read through the Psalm and have a sense of the kinds of things it's about. Now we want to understand what it means. How does it apply? And we'll talk about application in just a minute. But so we start with interpretation. So let's get the elements that we need to have in order to interpret it. The first thing we want to figure out is what are some tropes that are present in this psalm? And I'll give you simple examples. I'm not going to try to point out all the tropes. We'll go through them without referring to them while we're actually teaching the psalm in the next episode, most likely. But in this one, just to identify an example of what I mean by tropes, the naming of all of these different places or people groups, Israel, Jacob, Judah, Egypt, Jordan, they're all named in 8 verses of this psalm. So it's important that we kind of understand how those words are being used. And so here's what I mean by noticing the tropes. If you take those names literally, literally is such a weird word, it's hard to kind of figure out what exactly that means, prima facie or something like that. But if you take it, most prima facie, most literally, normally we would take it to be a reference to the people who are the descendants of that person. So Israel, being Jacob, his descendants are referred to as Israel, but it's the people. So you're referring to the sort of nation, but, you know, the people themselves. So Israel is this or that. Jacob is this or that. Judah is this or that. So if you take it literally, it's a reference to the people. Same with Egypt and Jordan, by the way. If you take it as metonymy, where something stands for something else, it stands in its place, and sometimes it's a symbolic and direct connection, like the White House standing for the presidency kind of thing. As if you take those names as metonymy, they can stand for the land where those people live. And that's what's happening with Egypt, right? Egypt isn't about the people there. It's about the land that they had been occupying. And when they're leaving Egypt and then they go to Israel, for instance, Israel is the land where Israel lives. And so the name Israel is being used as a side reference for the land in which they're going to live, in the same way that the name can be used as a reference to the what we would now refer to as a state. Then it's not exactly the same thing we would refer to as a state, but the political society, you know, the whole organized group of people who have heads and leaders and all that kind of stuff. That's another reference that would be metonymic. The other option is synecdoche, where a smaller part represents the whole, and he's doing that, obviously, with Judah, not representing a single tribe in Israel, but representing Israel in the same way he uses Egypt and Jordan to represent the whole of those people one way or another. So as synecdoche, it could be the whole people. That becomes important, by the way, when we're interpreting just the second verse of the psalm. We have to figure out what that verse actually means. And I think it's a little ambiguous. We'll come back to it, talk about it when we get there. Secondly, after identifying the tropes, this one's a little bit easier. But if you read very much poetry, you start to notice the tropes. They're important. You know, Juliet is the sun. You recognize the metaphor that's used there. She's not a hot ball, you know, burning ball of gas. She's something that's lighting up the room for him, or shining for everyone, or creating warmth for him, or, you know, whatever it is. So it creates a stupid romantic literature. Anyway, you get the idea. You start to notice metaphors. You start to notice the imagery that's being used, and so you pay attention to it. And you also notice the ambiguity that's built into imagery, because once you introduce a metaphor, once you introduce some kind of simile or anything like that, you're also introducing ambiguity. You can take the comparison in different ways. But in what way do you mean she's like the sun? In what way do you mean this is Israel? Do you mean the land? Do you mean the people? Why do you have to mean just one? Couldn't you mean both? And lo and behold, you can mean both. So it opens up all kinds of doors for understanding the density of what could be in this case, in the psalm, when you recognize the imagery that's present, the tropes that are present. So identify the tropes. Secondly, identify the motifs. This one's easy. It's just structural. What are the elements that are repeated in the psalm or in the poem in general, but in this case in the psalm? So you look at the psalm and you have to know, it's not just vocabulary. It's not just the trick of, you know, looking at the words in the psalm and what word is repeated, although that makes it really obvious. If a word's repeated, you know, it's probably part of a motif in one way or another. So you look at words, particularly freight-carrying words. You know, they have significant meaning to them, not just the word the, right? So you look at freight-carrying words, and you see them repeated. Then you go, oh, there must be a reason he's repeating this. That becomes a motif, and it helps pull us back to the center of whatever's going on in that poem, right? So the motifs in Psalm 114 are pretty obvious. Number one, as the Exodus itself. So in verse 1, they went out from Egypt. They went out from the people of a strange language. In verse 3, the sea looked and fled. And then, and we begin to recognize something as soon as I say this next part, we begin to recognize that the Exodus is more than just walking across the Red Sea on dry land and getting out of Egypt. It's the whole encounter, the whole experience of leaving Egypt and going to and settling in Israel. The whole process, the whole 40 years is the Exodus in this kind of psalm. And so in this psalm, that includes the end of verse 3, Jordan turned back. So when they cross the Jordan and they go over past Jericho, you know, into the promised land and so on. In verse 4, the mountains skipped like rams, the hills like lambs. You know, we might not notice it, but having read through the psalm and now starting to follow the motifs, we realize that they're referring to Sinai. That's sort of the standard set place where the mountain shook, and you'll remember it smoking and so on when Moses goes up the mountain. We'll talk more about it when we actually do the psalm. In verse 5, it's repeated that we go back to the Red Sea that's fleeing, to the Jordan that's turning back, to the mountains that are skipping. In verse 6, the Exodus is constantly present in this psalm until the last two verses when we're pointing at something else. Although in verse 8, there's certainly a part of what is that broader perspective on the Exodus, which is God giving them water in the middle of the desert, right? So in verse 8. But I will talk about that one in just a second as a different motif. Well, let's not wait a second. Here it is right now. The second motif, and you might not notice this if you don't go back and just look through it and say, what elements are being repeated here? Not in vocabulary, but just in the content of what's being said. You can't ignore all the water in this psalm. It is constant. And it begins with it, with the sea looking back and fleeing, right, in verse 3. And the second half of that, the Jordan doing that. These are huge and significant events. Events Joshua himself is going to repeat to them when he says, you need to reestablish this covenant with God as I'm preparing to go up to heaven and you're going to have a new leader. You need to reestablish the covenant you established with God when your fathers crossed the river and when your fathers crossed the Red Sea and when we crossed the Jordan River. Each one is the crossing of this body of water, and he brings it back up here. In verse 3, in the sea looking back and the Jordan turning back. And then in verse 5, it comes up again, obviously because of the repetition between verses 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. The sea and Jordan again. But they, in this case, the Jordan itself and the sea are personified. So the waters are now taking on this life. Oh, you're scared of God, are you? That kind of idea, talking to the waters as if they have a personality, drawing attention to them. This is the thing. They're being repeated. We're supposed to notice what's happening with the water. And when we recognize those motifs, that last verse makes a little more sense, not because we understand it fully, but we have something to think about. When we get to verse 8 and we're in the middle of a desert and yet God is making pools of water, springs of water, there's something about that that brings unity to the psalm. Ah, we're right back to the water, not crossing the Red Sea, but out here in the middle of the desert, there's also water. But something's different in our relationship with the Red Sea and our relationship with the pool of water in the middle of the desert, right? So we'll figure that out. But if you notice the motifs, then you know to ask that question. So we've taken two steps so far, and I'm going to add one little element to the water here. I should say this before I say the other part. It is possible that in verse 1, and I think this is the case, but I couldn't prove it. It's one of those things that is in a culture and it's in a way of thinking about a land. But historically, in the books that I've read about Egypt, the way they think about their own land and the way the rest of the world in their time probably thought about their land and the way it's often described, Egypt in scripture in Hebrew is not called something that would be transliterated into Egypt. It's the word Mitzrayim, right? So that it's a totally different word, but it's, and you know, there's always argumentation about etymology, but one of the things that seems confident to be that we can say with fair confidence about the etymology of Mitzrayim is that it uses this ending in Hebrew that implies duality. And the nature of Egypt throughout history was its consideration as the home of the Nile, which meant there was an upper Egypt where the Nile is, you know, the valley flowing down into the lowlands that are the delta of Egypt. And so there's upper and lower Egypt, and that means the Nile Valley and the Nile Delta. And all that matters about that is that Egypt is the land of the Nile. Everything about Egypt's existence was about the Nile. It was about the waters of that river. And what Israel experienced in Egypt was where they were provided for in this birthplace with all the water being able to take care of them in the Nile, and the devastation that they experienced with their children being put into the river to die in this precursor to what would be the slaughter of the innocents under Herod, which would come up in a discussion about the psalm later. All of that, you know, is part of setting the tone for water just by bringing up Egypt. Not something we would necessarily notice immediately, that in the very first verse of the psalm, we would automatically be dragged into thinking about a land of water. But that statement, when Israel went out from Egypt, when Israel went out from the land of the Nile, we're already being introduced to a body of water. Then it's going to be the Red Sea. Then it's going to be the Jordan River. And then it's going to be pools in the desert. So water is just everywhere in this psalm. Even if you don't take verse 1 that way, the motif is hard to miss, the importance of water in this psalm. And so we've got what to do with that. We don't know yet. We don't care. I mean, we do care. We want to get there, but we don't care yet. All we're trying to do is get all these different elements that we know we're going to have to put together, because the psalmist put them together. He put them together into one passage and said, just sing this with me. Just sing this with me. Feel where this takes you. And now we want to study it with enough detail to understand how he got us there, where we were supposed to get. And especially because it's a different culture, it's helpful to get there with the details of it, sort of understanding how he got there, so we would get where somebody back then who was reading it might get, right? So this is part of the advantage to doing this. So we've done two things so far. Number one, identify the tropes. Number two, identify the motifs, which we said were the Exodus and water. I used as the example of the tropes. And obviously, water has all kinds of tropes built into it. And we will talk about some of those as we go through the psalm itself. I'm just giving examples right now. But the tropes were about the names that I was giving examples of. The motif was water that I was using. And then the parallels. So parallelism is built into all poetry. It's certainly foundational to Hebrew poetry. And there are plenty of commentators and authors who've written about parallelism in Hebrew scripture in general, but also in the Psalms. You find all kinds of parallelism in the Proverbs as well, and so on. But when you're in a psalm or in a poem, noticing parallels it's expansive. I mean, it can be anywhere. And you can get what people refer to as parallelomania, where you just see parallels everywhere. You know, you can make anything be a parallel. So what you want to do is make sure that you're noticing parallels that are unavoidable. Not just everything's parallel, but there are some things that you just have to see are parallel. So in this, and by, you know, by parallel, it can mean it says exactly the same thing. It could also mean it says exactly the opposite thing. It could be parallel because it repeats the pattern or structure exactly, or it could be parallel because it inverts the structure exactly. So it's called inverted parallelism when you hear people talk about chiasms. So there are all kinds of ways things could be parallel. You know, we're not going to go through all the details of how you'd get there, but it is fairly obvious if you pay attention to the details in the psalm. So in this one, it's really fairly obvious. You know, I don't know if those two words go together, but they're going to work for us today. It's really fairly obvious. So it's my way of saying it's not complicated, but not being insulting. If you pay attention to it, you can't miss that verses 3 and 4 are parallel with verses 5 and 6, right? So let me read them to you. Verses 3 and 4, the sea looked and fled, Jordan turned back, the mountains skipped like rams, the hills like lambs. Verses 5 and 6, what ails you, O sea, that you flee? O Jordan, that you turn back, O mountains, that you skip like rams, O hills like lambs. Now you can hear, I'm not trying to interpret the psalm right now. I'm not trying to read it with meaning. I'm just trying to notice the elements of it. That's why I'm reading it so pedantically there. But you can't miss. The sea is repeated. The Jordan is repeated. What they do is repeated. Looked and fled, turned back. The mountains are repeated. They skip like rams. The hills like lambs. All of those words are repeated. They're repeated exactly in those two sections. There's no way we're not supposed to see that. And you know, what does it do to change the meaning? Not a lot right off the bat, right? Because it's just saying exactly the same thing. Well, not quite. Because in the first one, we're just describing the event. The sea looked and fled. Jordan turned back. We're describing it metaphorically, poetically, with tropes. But I mean, it's just descriptive language. The sea looked and fled. Jordan turned back. The mountains skipped like rams. The hills like lambs. But now we're going to try to make a point. When we repeat it, we're speaking to the sea as if it's a person and saying, what ails you, O sea, that you flee? And what we have to do is recognize, therefore, he's repeating this to say, we were supposed to have learned something from this, or the sea was supposed to have learned something from this. So whatever it was that was supposed to be learned, we're going to know to pay attention to when we go to start trying to interpret the passage. So recognizing that parallel helps, but it also helps in another way, because as I've said a bunch of times in this podcast on different episodes, probably half the time that I talk about passages of any kind at all, you first have to grasp the structure of a passage. Then you try to understand the content of the passage. And that's all we're doing here. I'm implying part of the structure of a passage is its use of tropes or its use of motifs and its use of parallelism. That's part of understanding the structure of a poem. Poems are not about sentential grammar. Poems are about parallelism and tropes, all the kinds of imagery and language that can be used and stuff like that. So we're just studying structure by asking these questions. And in parallelism, one of the things that we get the advantage of is if there's a really obvious parallel, then it might point us toward a subtler parallel, right? So if verses 3 and 4, and this is part of the way parallelism works very often, if verses 3 and 4 are parallel to verses 5 and 6, then I'm tempted. I don't know that this will be the case. It might be suspect. It might be a symptom of parallelomania, right? That verses 1 and 2 might be in some way parallel to verses 7 and 8. Now, I don't think they're strongly parallel in this psalm. It's not the kind of repetition that you would normally expect in a psalm. But something's going on where I should be able to look at verses 3 through 6, recognizing the repetition and parallelism that's taking place, and realize that whatever they accomplish, whatever happens in verses 3 and 4, and then verses 5 and 6, whatever's changed in there is what I will realize has changed in me when I read verses 1 and 2 and then come out of the psalm in verses 7 and 8. So in verses 7 and 8, I'm going to assume that what changed in verses 3 through 6 is now being realized in whatever's being said in verses 7 and 8. So whether it's a form of parallelism or not, and I think, by the way, I think it is. As we talk about the psalm itself, I think you will see why I think it is. Not a sentential one, not a grammatical one, but in content. What's happened in verses 7 and 8 is it's not inverted, but it's very similar and carries us content-wise in an opposite direction than what would have taken us into verses 1 and 2. We're coming out of verse 7 and 8 with a lot more than you would expect if you just read through the psalm casually. So again, I'm not trying to make that point of what the content of that is today, but I do want to make the point that I think we're going to get there because we notice verses 7 and 8 go with 1 and 2. Now, all of that said, I could say that as simply as this. It would be really, I don't know which way to say this, negatively or positively. I'll say it negatively. It would be difficult not to notice that verses 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 go together, and therefore that you're left over with verses 1 and 2 and verses 7 and 8. And by doing that without any content whatsoever, I've realized that the psalm breaks up into four pieces. If it breaks up into only three pieces, it would be like this, and this works. Verses 1 and 2, and then verses 3 through 6, and then verses 7 and 8. There's no way not to see that structure in the psalm. You're trapped in it once you notice any of the elements that are present in it. That helps me to understand the flow of what the psalmist is doing. And that's why I want the way I approach the psalm to conform to that structure. So verses 1 and 2, and then I'm going to do either verses 3 and 4, and then verses 5 and 6, and then verses 7 and 8, or I'm going to do 1 and 2, and then 3 through 6, and then 7 and 8. I'm choosing the latter. I'm choosing 3 through 6, because even if they are to be taken separately as two different pairs of verses, they still combine so strongly that it's easy to talk about them together. And let's be clear, the psalmist did not give breaks to us. He did not put in it, here's heading one and here's heading two. So my way to do it is not the only way to do it. And it's not important that I get the only way that you possibly could have broken up this psalm. What's important about this entire method, everything I've given to you to this point, the important thing about it is only that I'm having to pay attention to every single part of the psalm. I'm having to notice every word. I'm having to pay attention to every phrase, and I'm trying to pay attention to every relationship that's being established in the psalm between this phrase and that one, between this section and that one. So if I'm not ignoring anything, then I might be forced to understand better what the psalmist wanted to get at. And in fact, you will notice, Daisy was just pointing this out, by the way, that in the Bible that you have, you know, the printed version of the Bible you have, it probably breaks up the psalm in one of those ways. Very often, and I want to give you some liberty when you're reading the scriptures, because people are very knowledgeable who do those translations and who make that effort to help you understand it just by creating those visual cues and how they put it into the scripture. And that can be very helpful. But you're not bound by that either. And so I want to encourage you to use some liberty when you're coming at the text and say, oh, well, they broke it up between verses 4 and 5. But actually, I think verses 3 through 6 should all go together. It's okay to do that. That's not part of the original past text that was given to us. So use some discretion with the sense and the reality that God has given you his book and he's given you his spirit. And that doesn't mean that you can ignore the scholarship of other people. It doesn't mean you can ignore what the text actually says. But it does mean you can submit to the text yourself, and not just have to have someone else give you every possible meaning that it could have. So we can come at things different ways. That doesn't mean there's no objective content. I didn't say that at all. There is objective content there. But if you think you control all of the objective content because you've done the very best work you've ever done in your entire life on a passage, and you've spent your whole life doing it, then you are underestimating the nuance with which God can speak to his people. So we're never going to contain the whole, and that gives us a whole lot of freedom in making sure that we do understand what God absolutely is saying to us. Like, I don't want to read the psalm to get out of it the things that might be there. I want to read the psalm to get out of it what there's no way God is not saying. I know Daisy loves those double negatives, so I'm just going to throw it in there. Okay, so anyway, so on the poetry part, what we've really been doing is just trying to grasp some of the structure of the psalm and why we're going to break it up the way that we do. The other part, though, in interpreting a psalm that I want to give you, and this is what we'll close with today, and then the next episode we'll actually cover Psalm 114, and you'll have a sense of why I picked out the elements that I did. And so the other part of this is specific to the psalms. It's not just poetry, but to the psalms. Oh, wait, before I say that. The other thing on poetry, but this is true about all literature, not just poetry, is to read it iteratively. Don't just read it once and think you know what it said. Read it and then reread it, understanding it a little better than you did the last time. And then study all those elements and then reread it, having looked at all those elements, and know that you don't understand it yet, but you're starting to figure out how some of those pieces fit together. And then read it again and then go, oh man, I was thinking it meant this when it said his place or his people or something like that earlier, or his sanctuary. But now I realize it means this other thing. It could mean both, or it might mean only the latter, and that you were supposed to get there over time. The point is, read it iteratively. As I have said many times in many episodes, there is no reading. There's only rereading. That's when you start to grasp things, when you reread them. You start to pick up on the nuances. Okay, so anyway, read it iteratively. Now, this part for the Psalms uniquely, You have to do three things. For the Psalms, you have to hear it this way. I find it mesmerizing that we ignore this all the time. And I've said this from the very beginning when we did Psalm 2, which I think we did on air. I think we did an episode of Psalm 2. I focused on how important it was to stop thinking that I am the narrator in the psalm, and start hearing it in the mouth of other people, right? So I might be praying a psalm in the mouth of Absalom. I might be saying it in the mouth of David. But the psalm also entails, by the nature of being a psalm, therefore being this hymn that the people of God sing together, the people of God originally being Israel, right? So that we have to hear the psalm in three different mouths. Number one, we have to hear the psalm in the mouth of Israel. That's who picked it up and read it first. That's who picked it up and sang it. They're the ones who sang it in worship together. They are, in this psalm, the ones who sang it over the Passover table together. So we have to hear it in the mouth of Israel. And for example, that can mean that we need to hear this psalm in the mouth of the people of Israel when they're being held in captivity in Babylon, for instance, or when they're being taken captive. We have to hear it in the mouth of the people who sang it first. So first, hear the psalm in the mouth of Israel. Take it out of your own devotional sense and put it back into the mouths of the people who were singing it first. Not because we're going to keep it there, but we have to understand what it meant to them to understand what it meant, right? I mean, this is the whole point. And then we can understand what it means. So in the mouth of Israel, we have to hear the psalm. Secondly, we have to hear the psalm in the mouth of Jesus, which is the same thing as saying hear it in the mouth of Israel, because he is the real Israel, right? As the New Testament tells us over and over. I'm not dismissing the importance of Israel or their future. I believe in all of that. But I'm talking about understanding who Jesus is. He is the personification, the embodiment, the reality of what everything about the Son of God is. The Son of God, as he refers to Israel in Egypt, it is Jesus when he comes into the world, right? So in the mouth of Jesus, we have to hear the psalm, meaning it's messianic in one way or another, every psalm. And in reality, Jesus prayed all these psalms, and it meant something when he said them. So imagine this psalm in the mouth of Jesus returning from Egypt after the slaughter of the innocents. Imagine this psalm in the mouth of Jesus growing up, remembering with his parents what it meant to move from Egypt when you leave Egypt, right? To go back to the land of Israel when he's being raised in Nazareth. Or imagine this psalm in the mouth of Jesus when he's rising from the grave and he's telling the earth to tremble before Yahweh. That'll do it, won't it? Anyway, imagine this psalm in the mouth of Jesus. So first, and I'm not saying just imagine, it was in their mouths. So hear it in the mouth of Israel, then hear it in the mouth of Jesus, and then understand it in our own mouths. When we've heard it in the mouth of Israel and when we've heard it in the mouth of Jesus, then I think we can understand it as we literally hear it coming out of our mouths. And I will say to you that the nature of poetry is that it should be read out loud. It is the sound of language that makes poetry what it is. And I don't mean by that you can't study it quietly or something like that, but if you want to get a poem, you need to say it. You need to read it. You need to practically sing it. It is the flow of the language that makes it poetic. And so when you literally read this psalm after you've studied it and tried to grasp it and understand it, then when you read it out loud and actually understand it, it will be understood in your mouth because you first heard it in the mouth of Israel and then in the mouth of Jesus. And so understanding it in our mouths in a psalm like this means we will understand what redemption from bondage is, what the promise of a new life is, what ongoing dependence on God means for us, and what it means to have faith that he's going to make the rest of the world right. Okay, so there are some tools for understanding the Psalms, and hopefully they will be helpful. Again, on the poetic side, look at the tropes, look at the motifs, look at the parallels that are present, read the psalm iteratively, having looked at all of that, and then hear the psalm in the mouth of Israel, hear the psalm in the mouth of Jesus, and then finally understand it in our own mouths as we sing back to God the words he's given to us.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.